On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Economist Joseph Stiglitz has won the Nobel Prize, was chairman of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors, been chief economist at the World Bank, and he's made waves everywhere he's gone. His 2002 bestseller, Globalization and Its Discontents, captured the apprehension of a world twirling in the churn of a globalizing economy, from outsourcing and layoffs in America to revolutionary change abroad. Now he's back with a warning that globalization is going off the rails and needs some serious fixing. New rules on trade and the environment and labor. Critics say he's dreaming. Stiglitz says we'd better dream fast. Up next on Point, making globalization work with the in-your-face Nobel Prize winner, Joseph Stiglitz. Later in this hour, we'll hear from a Stiglitz critic and free market champion, Zanny Mitten-Beddoes, Washington economics editor for The Economist magazine. But now, joining me from New York is Joseph Stiglitz, winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2001. He's former chair of the Council of Economic Advisors under President Bill Clinton, former chief economist at the World Bank, a job he was pushed out of at the end of 1999 for his vocal criticism of the IMF and U.S. policies. His best-selling 2002 book, Globalization and Its Discontents, sold a million copies, made him an intellectual hero of the anti-poverty movement. Currently a professor of economics at Columbia. His new book is Making Globalization Work. Professor Stiglitz, thanks very much for being with us.
Nice to be here.
So what's not working?
Actually, a lot of things aren't working. One of the things that in the beginning of the globalization debate not that long ago was the hope that everybody would be better off as a result of globalization. In fact, there are a lot of losers. In some countries, there are probably more losers than winners. So while globalization may increase overall production, it is also leading to a set of forces that are depressing incomes, particularly of those at the bottom. And this inequality is perhaps the most serious problem with globalization today. But there are other problems as well. Large numbers of countries facing debt crises. The fact that money, rather than flowing from the rich to the poor, is flowing from the poor countries to the rich. The trade regime, everybody recognized that the last round of trade negotiations, the Uruguay round that ended in 1994, was unfair. But they didn't really realize how unfair it was. The poorest countries were actually worse off. Then there was an agreement to do something about this. The so-called development round began in November of 2001. Europe and the United States made promises, and now they've actually reneged on those promises, and so those talks have essentially broken down.
Joseph Stiglitz,
so these are just a couple of the examples.
And we'll go on in to those woods and want to hear your analysis on many fronts, but I guess the big picture, you know, defenders say, look at India, look at China, look at the advances that have been made in many places around the world. No, it's not perfect, but on balance, this is the path we've got to be on. What's your problem with it, Joseph Stiglitz?
Well, yes, globalization has brought enormous benefits to some countries, and there's absolutely no doubt that China, India are among the successes. And we should never underestimate the magnitude of those successes as a result of globalization, access to international markets, access to technology. China has moved hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. So I'm a great cheer for globalization when it's managed well. And China is an example of a country that has managed globalization well. At the other extreme, while standard economic theory had predicted that there would be convergence, the disparity between the poorest countries and the richest countries would narrow, in fact, there's been divergence. Even take the case of our next-door neighbor, Mexico. We signed an agreement with Mexico called the North American Free Trade Agreement. Mm. One of the arguments behind that was that it would lift the incomes of the people in Mexico that were one-sixth that of the United States. That would reduce migration pressure. We would both benefit. In fact, in the first decade of NAFTA, the disparity between the United States and Mexico actually increased.
So let me ask you this. You acknowledge that there have been successes and very big ones, hundreds of millions of people in India or China who have been brought up. So take us to the sort of weight of your argument. Are we arguing at the margins of globalization here, or are you saying, Joseph Stiglitz, that there's something fundamentally wrong? What's the scale of risk we're talking about with the problems you see?
Well, what I'm arguing is that when globalization is managed well, then it can bring enormous benefits that are widely shared, and China is perhaps the best example of where it's been reasonably well managed. But where it's not managed well, it may bring increases, but the of income, but the increases of income are go to a few people at the top. The winners could compensate the losers, but they don't. And unless we do something about the way we manage globalization, there will be potentially so many losers that there can be a backlash. Sometimes people say globalization is inevitable. We just have to swallow the pill.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that before World War I, globalization is measured, for instance, by the ratio of trade to GDP or
right.
capital flows to GDP was much stronger than it was in the interwar period. So there can be a backlash.
What's your charge here? Are you saying that the inequities that exist in globalization are deliberate? In the book, you say after the Cold War, there was a chance to sort of get out of that old dynamic and build a new system that was based on values and principles that would help everybody. You say the advanced industrial countries actually created a global trade regime that helped their special and corporate financial interests and hurt the poorest countries of the world. Are you charging that this was deliberate, that this is a deliberately rigged game?
I don't know if I say it's deliberate, but during the period of the Cold War, there was competition. We had to fight for the hearts and minds of those in the Third World, or at least we wanted to make sure they weren't going over to the other side. So we make sure that the regime was at least a certain degree of fairness. After the end of the Cold War, one of the first things we did is to sign a new trade agreement that actually, as I said before, made the poorest countries worse off. One of the problems that I identify here is sometimes called the democratic deficit, that when we make those rules for running globalization, the international trade agreements, international corporations are there at the table. They're telling the negotiators what is in the interest, not of America, but the interest of their companies. And the negotiators listen. The broader interest of society as a whole is not at the table. In the past, civil society, ordinary American voters have not been engaged. The issues of international policy, economic policy, never enter into the debate in the level of the presidential debates except at the fringe. And so there is a open opportunity for these international companies to try to shape it in their interest. So it's not as if they want to do harm to the other countries. They're only trying to get for themselves what is in their interest. The fact that in doing that they harm some others is sort of incidental damage, but it turns out when looked at from the system as a whole, it becomes extraordinarily important.
So here we are. The IMF and World Bank have been meeting in Singapore in this last week, and lots of speeches there going after the big economic powers, going after the U.S., China, other fast-growing companies wanting a bigger say, developing countries wanting a bigger say. But you've been a big critic of the IMF and World Bank, for that matter. When you say that the answer is to manage globalization better, you know, a lot of free marketeers' antenna are going to go up and they're going to say, wait a minute, what are you saying, Joseph Stiglitz? You want more government paws in the soup here as if government's going to fix this? You know, the market may not be perfect, but it's going to be better than a global bureaucracy trying to get its mitts around the global economy. What do you say to that?
Well, actually, in a lot of these areas, I'm supporting more market, not less market. The problem is the way the rules are being written, they're not really free trade agreements. Let me give you an example. The last trade agreement, the Uruguay round, if they wanted a free trade agreement, you could have written a free trade agreement in just a few pages. Same thing about the North American free trade agreement. You can just say there will be free trade, there will be no subsidies, etc. In fact, these free trade agreements go on to literally thousands of pages. Why? Because every special interest piles in with a particular provision to try to protect themselves, advance their own interest. So what we have today is not a free market-based globalization. What we have today is a globalization that has been seized by some particular special interest. So in a way, what I'm concerned about here is trying to actually give more opportunities in many of the areas for markets to work. Let me give you just one example. The agricultural subsidies, which have been a center of a lot of the debate, the United States gives $3 to $4 billion of cotton subsidies a year.
Right, huge.
Goes to 25,000 rich cotton farmers. Most of it actually goes to 15% of that. So we're talking about 3,000, 4,000 people. Meanwhile, the United States, without those cotton subsidies, would not be an exporter, or certainly not a major exporter. We become a major exporter. Prices go down. 10 million subsistence farmers in sub-Saharan Africa have their income cut and their livelihood put more and more at risk.
Here's UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, gloomy on globalization, in his speech before the General Assembly this week.
Globalization is not a tide that lifts all boats. Even among those whose statistics tell us are benefiting, many are deeply insecure and strongly resent the apparent complacency of those more fortunate.
The apparent complacency of those more fortunate, it's not shared by Joseph Stiglitz. Of course, many disagree with his recipe here, but Professor Stiglitz, begin to take us into your fix-it list, if you would. So you've got a lot of very specific arguments here, suggestions for new rules, I guess we'd say. Take us into the top.
Well, the first thing is to pick up on what Kofi Annan said. It's not a tide that lifts all boats. That is at the heart of the problem. In fact, there are a lot of asymmetries in the way globalization has been managed that deliberately almost wreck some of the boats at the bottom. So it's not just that there's collateral damage. It's almost the way it's been designed. Let me just give you one example that is very deep concern to developing countries. And that is that while we've liberalized capital flows, not perfectly, but enormously, we haven't liberalized labor flows. And that means that capital is in a better bargaining position. If you try to tax capital, they say, we're going to leave. On the other hand, unskilled labor doesn't have that choice. So when you do that kind of asymmetric liberalization, you change the distribution of tax burdens. Therefore, you have an asymmetric effect on the distribution of well-being.
Okay, let's just pick that one up. What would you do about it? How on earth do you intervene globally on such a huge labor pool?
Well, the first point to recognize is that we have been intervening. We have been changing the rules. But the way we've been changing the rules has focused on only one side of the game. So the first important lesson is to try to think a little bit more carefully about how we can liberalize in a more balanced way. So in this particular case, you may not open the doors to the flood of immigration, but what you could do is open up the doors more to unskilled labor services like construction services, services of maritime services, services that the less developed countries can provide, and that will at least rejigger it in a more balanced way.
But what about the American worker here? Are you saying if we're going to have globalization, then China's labor rate should be the same as the UAW's so that the American worker is not thrown off his horse?
Well, actually, one of the points that I emphasize in the book is that one of the unadvertised consequences of full globalization, which the advocates of globalization have never mentioned, is that full economic integration would mean exactly what you said. That is to say, unskilled workers in the United States, unskilled workers in the UK, unskilled workers in China and India.
Or auto workers who aren't exactly unskilled.
The unskilled would all get the same wage. Yep. And the same thing for every level of skill as we go up the level of skill. There would be that wages of every category would be exactly the same all around the world. And that means for a number of categories of labor, unskilled, medium skilled, even reasonably middle skilled levels, would fall in the United States. The response is twofold. And again, examples of where there's a concrete agenda. What we need to do is increase the level of education so that we can compete more effectively, strengthen the safety nets, have a more progressive taxation, recognizing that there are a lot of losers in the system, and we ought to redirect our whole income tax welfare system to recognize that there are these losers.
But the way
instead, too often, globalization has been used as an excuse for allowing wages to fall at the bottom, for allowing job protections to be cut, for arguing that we have to actually cut taxes and therefore cut benefits that are directed at the bottom. So in a sense, the politics has augmented the inequalities created by the market rather than trying to offset them.
What losers are you most concerned about here? It seems like the developing world is your main focus. You're saying it's not working for them. Can we follow the Stiglitz formula here and have both better-off poor citizens of the world and well-off American citizens of the world?
Yes, we can. And that is actually the hardest, the most important challenge. Yes, the book is concerned a great deal with the less developed countries, but it's also concerned about those at the bottom, even the middle in the United States. The median family income in the United States income today is lower than it was 5 years ago. If we look at the real wages of those at the bottom, real wages have actually fallen, not just in the last few years, but over the last 30 years. So this is not a short-run problem. This is a real long-run problem. What I argue is that a lot of the way globalization has been shaped has been by the special interests, so that, for instance, American taxpayers lose as a result of these subsidies to cotton, subsidies to corn. Those are examples where we're in a lose-lose situation. Americans are worse off as taxpayers, as citizens, and those in the developing countries are worse off.
Your critics call you the master of the art of the impossible. The Financial Times says your proposals are increasingly quixotic. Is this realistic stuff or is this dreamy stuff?
Well, some of these changes that I describe not only can be achieved, I believe they will be achieved in the not too distant future. At the same time,
by choice at the business end of a disaster.
Well, that's exactly the point. Thank you for making that point. The view that I take is change is going to occur. There's no doubt about that. Change will occur. And the real question is, are we going to be master of that change? Are we going to be thinking about how we can reshape before the disaster occurs, or will there be a disaster and then we have some patchwork and we try to fix it and then we muddle on to the next disaster and on and on and on. And this book is written in the hope, I don't think it's quixotic, but in the hope that we will take charge of our destiny and try to reshape it before it's too late. One example of the kinds of forces that are already at play, I talked a lot about the cotton subsidies. You might say, well, you know, aren't you just preaching, you'll never be able to get them to give up those cotton subsidies. But in fact, one of the major achievements in 1994, the new trade agreement, was the establishment of the beginnings of a rule of law. It was an unfair rule of law, but it still was a rule of law. And Brazil brought a case against United States cotton subsidies and won. The United States will appeal. They'll lose. It will take several years. There'll be a lot of, you know, scrapping. We'll try to reconfigure it to say, well, okay, now we've satisfied it. And they'll say, no, you haven't. And this will go on for a while. But the fact is, eventually, we will give in. And the same thing about in Europe, the agricultural subsidies are breaking the bank in Europe. There's a lot of opposition. They're going to change.
Joseph Stiglitz saying we're going to get a new regime in the global economy. We can do it the easy way or the hard way. He says it's time to take the toolkit out and get to work on it. Critics say, and we'll hear this voice and soon say, keep your mitts off this. Joseph Stiglitz, a lot of listeners want to join this conversation as well. Matt's calling from Boston. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Joseph. I'm a great admirer of the show. I think it's the best show on radio, not to take anything away from the other great WBUR shows.
Thanks, and, Matt. What do you see right here on globalization?
Well, I'd like to just ask Joseph what his opinion is on the idea that the United States economy, as well as some of the Asian economies, really developed under a kind of protectionism before they opened up their markets, in the sense that there was a book that I read, you know, years ago in college called Kicking Away the Ladder. I think the author was Ha Jun Cheng, and his point was that economies like the United States developed in a certain kind of isolationism and a protectionism, and then when it was advantageous for them, they decided to advocate the idea of free trade as a way to kind of cement the present relations between
Matt, look at India, look at China. They've done awfully darn well under the more open trade system lately, haven't they?
Yeah, that is true. And I'm not an expert on economics by any stretch of the imagination. So I just wanted to see what Mr. Stiglitz, had to say about that.
Let us pick it up. It's a great question. Joseph Stiglitz,
sure.
What about it?
Sure. Ha Jun's book is a very good book, which I'd recommend to everybody. And if you look through it, you'll see exactly his metaphor. Kicking away the ladder is a good metaphor for what has actually gone on. Now, you ask a good question about what about India. India is actually an interesting case. Its growth spurt began in the early 80s when they changed their policy not to international trade, but to business in general. They had been very anti-business.
Right.
Markets are important, and if you're anti-business, anti-markets, you're not going to be able to grow. It was that critical change that began the growth spurt in India, and they've since then been growing at 5%.
But surely it's the more globalized economy for India and China that has let them sell all over this planet and take, as you say, again, hundreds of millions out of poverty.
Exactly. So let me make it clear. I am not against globalization, but what China did, as I said, was made very careful. They didn't take away the tariffs immediately. They made sure that as they took away the tariffs, they created new jobs. They tried to keep employment as full as possible. They tried to make sure that they managed globalization so poverty fell, and it fell dramatically. It didn't happen accidentally. It happened as a result of deliberate government actions. Mm. The other part of the world, Latin America, that followed the recipe of free markets, let's see what happened there. They had enormous volatility, booms, busts, and the people at the bottom wound up worse off. It didn't work.
Joseph Stiglitz, stand by. I want to bring another voice in here. Joining us from Washington is Zanny Mitten-Bedos, Washington economics editor for The Economist magazine. It's been pretty tough on some of your suggestions here. She covers the American economy, policy issues surrounding globalization. Former economist, Zanny is, with the International Monetary Fund. Zanny Mitten-Bedos, thanks very much for being with us. What do you think of Joseph Stiglitz's recipe for fixing up globalization?
Well, I guess my perspective is that I think Joe looks at the world and sees globalization as a glass that's half empty, and I look at it and see it as a glass that's half full. It seems to me that he is putting too pessimistic a spin on exactly what globalization has achieved, and I think it's not nearly as bad as he makes out, and that the emerging world is actually doing pretty well. You know, over half of global growth last year came from emerging economies. Emerging economies, as you were saying earlier in the show, many of the big ones are booming, and it's not just China and India. It goes much further down the food chain.
But so, if half or something like that of the glass is empty, depending how you want to emphasize it, Zanny, what's the problem with getting in and trying to fix that? If it's anywhere near half, that's a lot of people.
Absolutely. And I'm all for fixing things, and there are a lot of things that need fixing. And it was interesting. I've been listening to your conversation, and there's a huge amount that I agree with. I mean, I think that the agricultural subsidies in the rich world are outrageous. I think free trade would be much better. A proper free trade regime would be much better. And I found myself, as I was reading this book, agreeing with quite a lot of the things that were in it. Where I think I guess I disagree is that I think the assumption in this book is that governments are basically generally good, and government solutions are needed to help things work better. And it sits a little ill with the analysis that says actually the IMF and the World Bank have been pretty disastrous, because when you look at the specific solutions that Joe offers, they are often more international organizations or more international governance. And he has a sort of an assumption that somehow these new ones that he's suggesting are going to work much better than the ones that we've got right now. And I guess I'm just a bit more pessimistic about that.
Joe Stiglitz, what about that? If you're going to get in there with the toolkit, who's going to have their hands on the tools, and why will they be any better at it than the IMF, which you've been very critical of, the World Bank?
Well, the main point I try to raise is that we need to democratize these institutions. I'm not an advocate of big government or big international government.
But you want intervention on many fronts, and we'll try and get to more of them here. I mean, someone's going to be making that intervention.
There is intervention already. For instance, in the case of drugs, there has been intervention strengthening intellectual property rights in ways that make generic medicines less accessible. So the government's there. There's no question about that. The question is, should the government be there just for the drug companies to make generic medicines less accessible, or should it be there to try to promote research for the diseases that affect the developing countries?
Zanny, how about it? Big powers have their paws all over this already. Let's get institutions in there that have the ordinary people's interest in mind.
Well, you know, big powers do have their paws over the existing international institutions. The first point is that actually the institution that Joe is most concerned about, the IMF, is in fact the one that is going some way right now to try and begin redressing the governance issue by increasing the voice of the big emerging economies.
Just this week in Singapore,
yes. Exactly, just this week. But beyond that, I think you have to take into account that political realities, you know, are there, and it is all well and good to say one should have a completely democratic system of internet global governance. But the truth is that richer countries are more powerful countries, and they are, it's just, in my view, not realistic to suggest that we should suddenly build up some kind of global governance regime that doesn't reflect that.
But if the imbalance is so severe, what if we end up with the crisis that hits the big countries as well?
The question is, what are the best ways to improve the globalization that we've got? And I agree with you, we can decide whether the glass is half full or half empty. There are plenty of things that are not perfect and that need to be improved, and I'd be the first person to admit that. But in my view, what this book does is it says, well, let's, you know, go back to the drawing board and create what seems like a sort of a perfect set of solutions if you had perfect governments, if you had complete full global democracy. And my approach would be to say, you know, that's interesting, it throws up some interesting intellectual arguments, but we're actually in the real world.
A lot of listeners have been waiting. Let's turn to Kalamazoo, Michigan. And Jason, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Stiglitz. I had a question. You talk about free capital flows and free labor flows, and I was just curious if you had any comments about environmental regulations that were standardized across the board.
Oh, yes, he does. Joseph Stiglitz, the environment, what would you do?
Well, I have a whole chapter on exactly that issue. One of the real problems facing many developing countries is that mining companies come in to countries, take out the natural resources, use limited liability as a cover. After they've taken out the resources, the environmental degradation is there. Comes time for the cleanup, and they say, we have no money left over. It's sort of like the bandits used to go across the state boundaries. They go back to their home country, protected from being chased across those boundaries. I say all that ought to stop.
So what do you do?
Well, there are a number of things you ought to do. You can have better bonding provisions. You ought to be able to pierce the corporate veil when people behave very badly with respect to the environment.
What about whole countries, China, for example?
Well, I think that violating basic environmental standards ought to be something that actually ought to be sanctioned within the WTO. When it, particularly when it relates to a global a global environmental problem like the ozone depleting gases or CO2.
What about the U.S. in that case? Would the U.S. take a hit in your vision here? I mean, we put out more exhaust than anybody.
Yes, it would. I think if you're going to keep the world from frying, if we're going to have a world environment that we can live with, we have to have rules, and all countries have to obey those rules. Right now, I just had a meeting on Saturday with some of the top scientists, and they said, you know, this is very different. Most of the other areas, scientists are feel that the general population is excessively worried about one chemical or another. This is a case where the scientists are really worried. Melting of the Arctic ice cap, the whole set of...
And right on down that list, and we know the list, Zanny Mittenbeddoes, how about it? Joseph Stiglitz says this isn't mumbo jumbo or anything like it anymore. It's a real issue. You pose yourself as the voice of the real world here. So do you see a readiness in the economy, in the business world, to jump in with the kind of solution Joseph Stiglitz is describing on the environment, let's say?
Well, let me say that I would completely agree with him that it's the environment, global warming particularly, is clearly a real issue. And I would submit that increasing numbers of people, even in the U.S., recognize that. And the U.S. has, as you know, been long the black sheep of the international community.
So he says, let's do something about it. Are you ready for that?
I mean, he's absolutely right. We should do something. And it's not as though there are enormous numbers of people going around saying we should do absolutely nothing. I mean, there's a rising chorus that we need to do something about it. The question is, what should we do and how do we go about it? And I think there are some interesting ideas in this book. And the proposal, which sounds very interesting in the abstract, that, you know, you should allow the WTO, which is the World Trade Organization, frankly, the only international organization we have that has teeth in the sense that it can allow countries to impose tariffs on other countries. You know, Professor Stiglitz wants to allow the WTO to impose tariffs on countries that don't fulfill environmental requirements.
Right.
My worry about that is that you are overloading the one international mechanism we have agreed that can impose sanctions to a point that a big country like the U.S., the U.S. Congress will say, well, we're just not having anything to do with this. And you always have to weigh up when you basically got to make sure you get people on board in designing global solutions. And, you know, it seems obvious that there are two possible routes in this environmental question. One is some form of carbon taxation, and the other is some form of trading of permit trading, emission trading permits. And the world is, it seems to me, intellectually the consensus is moving in that direction, and things are beginning to happen. They're not happening fast enough for those of us who think that this is a really big problem. I think ideas like Professor Stiglitz's are an important part of the debate. I happen not to think that that one is workable. I think it would risk wrecking a reasonably efficient system that we have in the WTO for trade right now.
Joe Stiglitz, Zanny, let me put that to Joe. Here, Zanny's magazine calls you the artist of the impossible. So how about it? The basic argument Zanny makes again is these changes have to occur incrementally. Your kind of sweeping recipe for change is more than the world can swallow or execute.
Well, actually, if you look through the book, most of the changes are incremental changes, and they are the kinds of things that could happen. In fact, there are already the legal framework. For instance, in the case of the issue we're talking about, the environmental pollution, there already was a case that the United States brought before the WTO. It was the case involving Thailand, where it was catching shrimp in nets that were killing endangered species of turtle. It said it had the right to stop the importation of these shrimp. Thailand, of course, challenged that. The WTO sustained the United States position. I had an opportunity to talk to one of the judges who was involved in the case. He said, and I asked him, were you aware of what implications this had for global warming? And they said, yes, we were. And what that means is that environmental issues trump trade issues when they are environmental issues of a global nature. If it is all right to stop trade, to use trade sanctions to protect a turtle, Surely it must be all right to protect our whole planet on which we all depend.
So there's Joe Stiglitz's Yertle the Turtle. Charlie's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Definitely in the Stiglitz camp. I wanted to ask him about a term that I see in the foreign press, but not in the U.S. press,
okay,
by critics of globalization, and that is neoliberalism. Is that a useful term, and what does it mean?
Joe Stiglitz.
Well, the term neoliberalism is the view that we should strip away the government, minimize the role of government, privatize, liberalize, focus not on macro stability in general, but just price stability. It is a useful construct. It's a way of summarizing a set of viewpoints about the role of government. In practice, too often neoliberalism isn't really neoliberalism. What it is that the government does intervene, but intervenes only in the interest of special groups, special interest, corporate interest. So there are, just like in the United States, we talk about free market ideology, but we wind up giving large amounts of corporate subsidies, and the level of those corporate subsidies, sometimes called corporate welfare, has actually increased in the last 6 years under an administration that would claim to be a free market administration. And this thing that we all know about what's happening in the United States is actually true in a lot of the so-called neoliberal regimes.
Let's go to St. Louis and Mike. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This whole idea of globalization, somehow that the state can do better, I think your guest just stated it, that it really ends up being the special interests of the larger powers and the larger corporations that set the agenda. The truth is that globalization is happening anyway, in spite of this, and when governments sort of interfere, and that's really the purpose of government. They're essentially interference methods and ultimately for some good purpose, but we need to limit that to the most basic interference possible, because ultimately it is the silent hand, it is the freedom of the market that produces the free trade, and it's been interference through trade over the years that has always limited the possibilities, and that's why this country is the leader of the world, because we represent the most freedom as a country and as a culture. So,
but I hear you, Mike. You're saying you're afraid that when there is government interference, it ends up being on behalf of special interests, not the wider crew. So let the free market reign.
The word is that you said the word right there. It's interference, and that always degrades freedom.
Mike, thanks for your call. Joseph Stiglitz, here we are. I'm looking at the Daily Telegraph here, quote unquote right-leaning in London, and they say, the kind of thing you're proposing would in fact deter entrepreneurs, investors, and lenders from ever setting foot in the developing world again. Mike in St. Louis says, please keep government out, because he's not confident of whose side they'll be on.
Well, first let me say I am a very strong supporter of markets. The fact of the matter is that the success of the United States has been based on a balanced relationship between markets and government in a number of aspects. For instance, what is the big driver of the economy in the last couple of years, last 10 years? It's been the Internet. How did the Internet come about? Well, the basic research that the Internet was based on was funded by the U.S. government. We all depend on education, technology, and a major part of that is funded, supported by the government. When we don't have adequate regulation, markets don't work. There have been a few experiments with what is called free banking. The last time that happened was when Pinochet in Chile listened to Milton Friedman, and they had free banking. They had a banking crisis, and the country still is paying for the debts that were accumulated to get out of that banking crisis. You need to have good banking regulation in order to have confidence in the banks where you're going to put your money. So the question isn't not whether there's going to be government or not. And the question isn't even whether we should have a big government or a small government. The real question is to figure out what the right thing for the government to do is. And what I've been trying to do is try to focus on what it is that the government ought to be doing in order to make the markets work, which in the end, I believe, is are at the core of the success of every economy.
Let's try and go through a quick punch list of some of your other big suggestions here and get Zanny's feedback as well. I don't know, lots of places we could start here. Let's look at intellectual property and patents. What would you change there, Joe?
Well, that's an extraordinary complicated issue. The criticism I raise is that the patent system creates a monopoly. That leads to an economic distortion.
But isn't that the point? Isn't we give people a monopoly for a fixed period so that they innovate?
That's right. Now, the problem is when you have the right balance of the intellectual property regime, you balance out this distortion, which is very large, with a benefit, which is more innovation. If you don't get it right, you get the cost without the benefit. There have been a lot of cases where it hasn't worked out right, and one of the cases that I point out is the use of the patent system to reduce access to generic medicines in the poorest countries of the world. And the drug companies have not been spending money on the diseases of the tropical countries. They spend more money on advertising and marketing.
So what do? You strip away their patent protection more quickly? You constrain the breadth of patents?
Well, the main idea that I focus on is a prize system. You have to have incentives. Research doesn't come from nowhere, and I agree with those who say you need to have incentives. But let's try to get the incentives to work in the right way.
And so I offer a government prize for companies or pharmaceutical people who come up with drugs for those tropical environments.
Exactly. And the more important the disease, the bigger the prize. And then use the markets to compete rather than monopolies. Use the market, competitive markets, to try to get the prices as low as possible rather than the monopoly, which is trying to get them as high as possible, so we can distribute the benefits of this research as widely as possible.
Zanny, a good intervention there. Set up a prize. If the market doesn't produce something, have a government do it for the world.
I would agree. I don't have any problem with that at all. In fact, the world is actually, as Professor Stiglitz knows, moving in that direction, because a lot of the diseases that are most problematic for poor people in poor countries are diseases where there's actually very little research done, because it's obviously not a huge market return for the drug companies. So I'm all in favor of prizes. I also think I would go further, and I think that we need to think about reforming patent law, and you know, the analysis is absolutely right. You have to trade off the gains from innovation against the costs of the monopoly. And it seems to me that in many areas we've erred too much the other way. Mm. I don't really see that as an indictment of globalization. I think that's it's an issue in the economy where we may not be in the right balance, and we need to think about redressing that balance. But it's not an indictment of the whole process of globalization.
Our time is short. Let us pick off another one, if we may, Joe Stiglitz. Open trade. And here, as I read you, you're saying every country should essentially completely open its borders to products from poorer countries, whatever they may be. Have I got you right?
That's right. And Europe has actually done this. They have what they call the Everything But Arms Initiative, where they opened up their markets to the poorest countries of the world. They recognized that the poorest countries are not a threat, and you don't need to have the reciprocal basis that have been the foundations of trade negotiations in the past.
How's the U.S. doing on this front?
Very badly. We announced a policy called 97%. We opened our markets to 97% of the goods. But it was what I called, rather than the EBA, Everything But Arms, EBP, Everything But What You Produce. Bangladesh can export jet engines, airplanes, all the things that they don't produce. But when it comes to the things they do produce, apparel, textiles, that's where the restrictions come in. In the case of Cambodia, that 97% opening means 0%. 100% of the things will be excluded under that 3%. In the case of Bangladesh.
So get wide open to products from the poor world. Joseph Stiglitz, is it ever going to happen on a timetable that meets with the threat you see, the risks you see?
Yes, I do think so. And the fact that Europe already has done it is indicative that there is strong support around the world. If Europe can afford it, so can we. And it would create a more – I think reducing poverty in these poorest countries, reducing despair, would actually create a more stable global environment. It won't cost us anything or very much, and I think the world would be a better place for it.
Zeni Mittenbedos, very short timer, in a few seconds. A lot of poo-pooing here in the international press, but you're saying maybe there's something here.
Well, in that, on this trade proposal, I think I would be rather more ambitious. I mean, simply opening your barriers, reducing your barriers to the very poorest countries is not enough. We need much lower barriers by everybody towards everybody. Mm. That's the basis of the global trading system. It needs to go much, much further. I want more liberalization. Mm.
We're out of time. It's a fascinating conversation. Zeni Mittenbedos at The Economist in Washington, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Joseph Stiglitz, author of the new book, Making Globalization Work, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.